To all who come to this happy place, welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome once again to the official Disneyland Resort podcast, a unique look at the magical moments and events here at the place where dreams come true. Join us each month as we celebrate the Year of a Million Dreams with a behind-the-scenes look at what's new and exciting here at the Disneyland Resort. And now, here is your host, Michael Gohagan.
Thanks for joining us. Summer is just around the corner, and you can already feel the buzz building here at the Disneyland Resort for exciting new attractions like Toy Story Mania. In fact, some lucky park guests have even had a sneak peek.
It was a sensory overload, but it was a lot of fun, and there's a lot of new things to see each time you ride it.
It's a combination between Roger Rabbit's cartoon spin and the Buzz Lightyear ride. It's like you get to kind of move around in the cart while at the same time getting to, you know, do a ring toss or a dart toss, and you get sprayed with water and air when you pop a balloon or something. It's really cool.
It's like a fast-paced experience of being inside Andy's room and playing with all of his toys.
Exciting new attractions like this are all part of the fun in the Year of a Million Dreams. In this edition of the Disneyland Resort podcast, we'll take you for a behind-the-scenes peek at the all-new Toy Story Mania. We'll also learn how music, sound effects, and narration are integrated into an attraction to bring it to life. Then come along to the Disneyland Park as we raise the curtain on Indiana Jones' Summer of Hidden Mysteries.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, even as I speak, Woody, Buzz, Jesse, Ham, Rex, and all my toy friends are inside setting up their games, and you're invited to play.
Recognize that voice? It's Don Rickles, the voice of Mr. Potato Head, one of the famous characters from the popular Disney Pixar Toy Story and Toy Story 2 films. Now, Mr. Potato Head is just one of the many characters who come to life in the all-new immersive Toy Story Mania attraction that's set to open June 17th at Disney's California Adventure. Inspired by the Disney Pixar films, this new attraction takes guests through a series of five midway games where they launch spring action shooters at a variety of targets. Now, to bring the midway games to life, Imagineers use the kind of cutting-edge 3D technology and special effects that only Disney can produce. To accomplish this, Disney Parks brought together the creative talents from both Walt Disney Imagineering and Pixar Studios. We caught up with Pixar's Roger Gould to learn more about this working relationship and the vision behind Toy Story Mania.
Well, as people can probably hear in the background, I mean, we're here in the middle of the park, but where exactly are we right now?
So we're sitting in the queue line, the unopened queue line for Toy Story Mania, and which is a very lovely building. But what's interesting is that in the queue here, we're still humans, in that we're human scale. And if you look up at the ceiling when you're here, you'll see that there are little, kind of like Christmas lights, but they're small bulbs. Well, once we go into the attraction, we actually shrink down to the size of a toy.
Well, now, so from the perspective of a park guest, what can I expect with this attraction?
What's really great about this attraction is that we're doing a bunch of things that we've never done before, which we like to do every time. So here we're taking kind of what we learned from the Buzz ride, which was a really neat way to make a ride that has interactivity. And we just said, how can we take that to another level? And it was actually Kevin Rafferty and Robert Coltrane, who were two longtime Imagineers, who came up with a basic premise of, what if we took classic Carnival Midway games and had them hosted by the Toy Story characters? And then the whole brainstorm was about, okay, well, in the movie, there are really two scales that we see, the human scale, and of course, when there's a human around, the toys go limp. And then there's toy scale, when the humans are away, they come to life, and we see the world down from that, you know, 8 inches off the ground level. And so we said, well, the toys going limp thing, that's not going to be that much fun. Guests come in and the toys go limp. So we said, let's go ahead and put us into the toy world. So literally, we've shrunk the guests in the sense we've blown up the toy world. So when we go into the ride, we are actually at toy scale. That means that Woody and Buzz and Jesse and everyone can speak directly to us as, you know, fellow toys.
Well, now, with kind of a, I guess, let's call it a canvas that rich of a film like that, I mean, how do you pick the particular aspects to kind of feature here?
Well, we knew we wanted it to be about the Toy Story characters as our host. The interesting thing was, once we said, well, this is in Andy's room, therefore this is a play set, this Midway Games playset that Andy has that he's left behind. So when he goes away, the toys are setting it up. Actually, the interesting art direction thing was that since we were going to mostly be seeing the playset here in the ride, that's not actually anything we've seen in the movie. So we really had this big question of how do we make this game that's not really of the movie remind you of the world that you see in the movie? And what we looked at is that film, although it came out in 1995, is really not... that bedroom, Andy's bedroom, is not a kid's bedroom from the early 90s. That really is a bedroom from the childhood of John Lasseter, Joe Rampt, Andrew Stanton P. Doctor, who created the film. So it's really a late 1960s, early 70s kid's bedroom. So we went back and we looked and said, well, what is a typical toy from that early 70s era? And what kind of materials do they use? And we pulled a bunch of different ones. But the one that I remember from my childhood, since I'm a contemporary of them, was a Snoopy and the Red Baron game. And which I had when I was 10, but I certainly have long since lost. But through the beauty of eBay, we bought one. And looking at it, we saw, okay, it really has only two component parts. It has pressed cardboard with printed characters on them, very roughly die cut, not that kind of tight precision thing that you would do today. And it has single color molded, unpainted plastic. And we said, okay, let's build our entire Mania playset out of printed pressed board cardboard that's loosely die cut and single color molded plastic. And it's one of these things that is kind of subtle. I don't think a guest is even going to notice that choice. But we said, well, we hope that that will make it feel like it's from the world of Toy Story. And in fact, there was a day when we rode with John Lasseter when we finally had that up and off. And he said, I feel like I'm in the movie. I'm like, okay, we got it.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, is the goal to transport the guest kind of to re-experience the film? Or is this kind of an additive element based around the film itself?
John Lasseter likes to talk about the fact that our characters, we want the audiences to imagine our characters live beyond the boundaries of the film. That we create a world that's so believable that you imagine that they are going on about their lives. And so this is really a great opportunity to literally make that come true. Here, the Toy Story characters, they're living beyond the boundary of the film. It's really, their lives have gone on, and now they've set up this playset. But it's not that you've entered the movie, you've entered the world of the movie, but it's just another day for Buzz and Woody and the gang.
Well, now, as somebody that kind of comes from the film world, what's been kind of the most interesting elements transitioning that to, a guest attraction?
I've worked on directing a lot of short films, and it's funny because typically a short film, 4 to 7 minutes, typically a theme park ride, about 4 to 7 minutes. And so there's something that's very similar in terms of the kind of the scope of storytelling we can do. But what's been so fun for me is this kind of crazy explosion of all the other disciplines that it takes to put it together an attraction. It's really more like putting on a piece of theater. We have physical sets, we have physical lighting. We of course have the engineering of a ride system and all of the things that come with that. It's this incredibly complicated puzzle, and I love solving these kind of puzzles, and it's really fun. And the collaboration is amazing because there are literally dozens and dozens of different disciplines that Imagineers bring to it that are well outside of the realm of anything we ever think about at Pixar.
When the attraction opens and guests are going through it, from a personal level, what are you most curious to see? I mean, what are you most excited about for the guests to experience?
For me, it's really exciting to see. I'm looking forward to seeing people just connect to these characters again. Because for me, the reason that we bother to make attractions inspired by any movie at all is because there's an emotional history that you bring from your love of the film that hopefully when you come to the attraction is sort of reawakened. And so seeing Buzz and Woody together again, seeing, oh, there's Rex and Ham, oh, and Bo Peep and Jesse, hearing You've Got a Friend of Me playing and the soundtrack, all those things hopefully just give you a rush of really positive memories that then when you get into that world, you already have a smile on your face. So I'm curious to see, that connection between people literally getting to look eye to eye with Buzz and Woody.
Now, one of the things most people are going to recognize immediately when standing in the queue area here is the Mr. Potato Head character. What can you tell us about that?
I can tell you that none of us really knew what we were getting ourselves into. Mr. Potato Head is, he may not have the most, we call them functions, which is basically how many different motors, how many different actions can they figure out. He may not have the most of any animatronic ever built, but he's up there in the top range. But what he does have the most of, he is the most animation ever made for an animatronic figure. Because we said, we've done living character shows, and if you've seen the Turtle Talk with Crush, or in Florida we have the Monsters, Inc. Laugh Floor, where Mike Wazowski has set up a theater to invite humans in to generate a lot of laugh energy all at once. Both of those are basically live digital projections of those characters, so it feels like you're watching kind of a live animated film. Here we wanted to take that notion, but bring it out into the dimensional world. We said, well, can we make a living interactive character as rich as Crush, but go ahead and do it with a 6-foot-tall Mr. Potato Head. And that's what we've done. But what that meant was that, because this is Don Rickles, the original voice of Mr. Potato Head, that all had to be pre-recorded. So we basically constructed dozens of different conversations that he can have with the guests. And that meant all the possible responses and answers and building out this incredibly rich and really complicated library.
Hurry, hurry, hurry! Right this way to Toy Story Midway Mania! It's a ride that's a game. It's a game that's a ride. Step right up and see what's inside.
Well, now, with Mr. Potato Head, I mean, you know, you can't help but see him as you walk in here. What's the experience I'm going to get when I get near Mr. Potato Head?
Well, you know, particularly if you go back and watch the first Toy Story, Mr. Potato Head, he's the skeptic of the group. He can be pretty harsh, but we didn't want to have a harsh potato out front here. He's basically here to act as the Carnival Barker, and the premise is that it's the Carnival Barker playset, you know, sort of dress up for this Mr. Potato Head. And so he's out here welcoming you to Toy Story Midway Mania and really being that classic Carnival Barker. So we've done, I don't even know, I think 7 or 8 recording sessions with Don Rickles. I mean, it's probably 16 or 20 hours worth of time. And it has just been the most fun I've ever had working with him. He is just, you know, he's famous as an insult comedian. You know, I grew up watching him, you know, on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and just being in awe of this guy. And so getting to meet him was a thrill. And I expected, okay, it's the insult guy. I've got to be prepared. He's this, you know, now 82-year-old sweet grandpa from Queens. And he was the nice guy. Did you get what you want? Is that okay? And I knew that things were going well because over the various sessions, then he would insult me more and more and more. And to the point where he would arrive at a session and see me and go, oh, and I was having such a good day. And it's just been great. I mean, there's no greater pleasure than being insulted by Don Rickles.
Well, now tell me, how does it work? But you've got Pixar, you've got Walt Disney Imagineering, you've got the resort. How does that all kind of collaborate together?
What's really cool is that the collaboration has been so wonderful because we all share the same goals. We're all looking to, you know, create something that's never been done before. We're all looking to use technology to do things that we couldn't have done before. It is fundamentally about collaboration. I mean, no animated film, no theme park attraction, no resort can ever be done by one person. It's hundreds and hundreds of people who work together to bring one idea to life. And what's great is that we all, Pixar Animation Studios and Walt Disney Imagineering and the resorts, all want to create a great experience that works for people of all ages and build it at such a level of quality that it's going to last literally for generations to come.
Well, now, as you mentioned, Toy Story first came out in 1995. I mean, you know, how does that transition into kind of, you know, current, up-to-date, with all the advances in computer animation, everything else that's going on?
You know, Pixar, we've made a lot of movies now, and, you know, for John Lasseter, it's like they're all his children. But Toy Story was the first, so, you know, you don't want to have a favorite, but you know, the Toy Story characters are so precious to John, and his enthusiasm and love of them is so great. What's amazing is that in 1995, you know, the fact that that film was even possible to get made is incredible in retrospect. You know, a single frame of the film would take up to 2 hours for the computers to generate. We've got characters in here that are playing with you, literally live playing with you at 24 frames a second. And it's like, wait, what's happening in a 24th of a second took 2 hours, you know, in 1995. And that's amazing. But what's really cool is, you know, Toy Story was the first computer animated film. The characters were built dimensionally, but we've never seen them in stereo projection. And here in the attraction, you're literally seeing them in stereo. They're dimensional in a way that you've never seen them before, and it feels so right and so natural to see them finally pop off the screen.
Well, I know a lot of people are looking forward to it, so thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Can't wait for everyone to ride.
Midway Mania! Can I make it any plainer? So come on.
Imagineers are constantly tinkering with different ways to enhance the guest experience. And one of the most important elements in the design process is sound. Think about Randy Newman's song, You've Got a Friend in Me. It created a theme that will forever be emotionally connected to the Toy Story films. But transferring that music from motion picture to an attraction is more difficult than you may think. Bruno Kuhn is an award-winning musician, composer, and music supervisor for film and video games, with credits on films like Toy Story 2, Cars, and Monsters, Inc. He sat down with us to talk about the challenges of creating the soundtrack for Toy Story Mania.
Well, I'm pleased to be joined this morning by Bruno Kuhn, and we're here in your home, and I think people might even hear kind of your dogs walking around in the background.
Yeah, that's Hannah and Allie trying to participate in this thing. We'll see if we can keep it to a minimum.
Well, let's start off by finding out a little bit about your background. Tell us about that.
Let's see. I've been a musician and a singer-songwriter for 30 years or so, and mostly interested in African and African-influenced music, singer-songwriter type stuff as well. And there's a big thread of that in American music, in the blues and in jazz, but also I like Latin music and Brazilian music, and pretty wide variety of those kinds of things.
Well, we're here today to talk a little bit about Toy Story Mania. From the point of view of somebody that's kind of charged with coming up with the soundtrack and the music for an attraction like that, how does that compare to say, working on a film score?
Well, in a film or a television, you are presented with a picture that's usually very complete, nearly complete, and you're trying to figure out a way to match somehow musically the shape and the direction that's taking, and underscore or amplify things within it. With a game or an attraction like this, you really aren't the main voice. The player is actually the main voice, and they end up being the melodic element that's most important. They're banging away at the game or you know, enjoying themselves. And you have to figure out a way to be a musical setting for that, add something to it, make it interesting, give it a color, a background color, without trying to take over the central focus ever. And it's kind of interesting.
So in this case, how did you accomplish that?
Well, in stages, one of the things we were trying to do was to focus on each section of the game a different character, and let that character be the color that the song because we were using the same song, You Got a Friend in Me, in each case, but we were trying to say, you know, if it's the pig, we're going to be in farmer land, or if it's, you know, the little green man, it's going to be, you know, out in space. What would spacemen do, you know, with this kind of melody? But so we completed that idea, and then when we put it in the game, it really excited everybody because it's great. Now it feels like something's happening, it's enjoyable and everything, but when you really put all the sound elements together and kind of a test case scenario of somebody playing the game, you realize, okay, you really can't hear much of any of that. I mean, what you're hearing is bang, 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 you know, that kind of thing. So you realize you have a few seconds ahead of time to set the stage for that kind of change of color, depending on what character we're focusing on, you know, Ham or whatever. And then you have to kind of get out of the way and make a pretty big hole to keep that thread going through it and keep it fun, but very lightly, because there's going to be a lot of other information besides music going on.
Bruno, tell me a little bit about the process with music.
Well, as I said, I'm a singer-songwriter from way back, and so the truth is I did demos by myself of everything that I could get my hands on. And I like that sound anyway, and they sound pretty amateurish, but they're fun. So I did all the guitar-based stuff. I did all the anything I could get my hands on. I played a little tuba and trombone on a couple of them, and I'd send them in, and then people would say, okay, that's close, but we want this or we want that to change. And then finally, when we got something that everybody agreed was a good direction and a good template based on my little homebrew versions, then we went to the studio and got live players and had everything performed. And it was an interesting thing to see it happen that way, because in many cases there was a lot of improvisation involved. You know, we'd say, this is a jazz style thing, we want this to feel this way, and we'd let a trombone player take a swipe at it, and you'd go, okay, that's good, let's take it again, let's see how that's going to be. And occasionally we'd end up with something really, really great.
In an attraction like this, where you're moving along, I mean, how do you accommodate for that? Because, you know, with a film, it's you're sitting there and you know when it's going to start and when it's going to end. But this one, you're kind of interacting with, and how do you make sure that the music works the whole way through?
Well, we're hoping for happy accidents, actually, a lot of the time, to tell you the truth. You know, we know what color we're looking for. We kind of solve the problem of introducing an idea that related to a character as you go into the ride, trying to hold on to that section of the ride. And then the transitions are where I get to actually musically do the most, because that's when I'm, you know, you get to actually hear the music for a minute. And then I think beyond that, we're just really hoping that little things catch your attention at the right moment that keep the excitement high. That's basically it. There's no way to predict. It is, you know, it's random. So there's no way to predict completely what you're doing. And that's true in video games as well.
Does the music start and kind of go the whole way through, or are there kind of scenes of music, so to speak?
Well, the interesting thing about it was that we had to compose a piece of music that it was multi-layered for each element. In other words, you're riding the game into a space, and there's one character that you're focusing on. But at that moment, you can actually hear the music from every other portion. So everything's playing at the same time. Like there's 8 or 10 versions of the song playing, and there's a military version that's very different than the version for Little Green Men, for example, which is, you know, theremins and that kind of thing, electronic voices. And so they all have to play together. They all have to be able to not sound like complete chaos. It's sort of an enjoyable chaos is what we were going for. But so it was difficult. It's like a big puzzle trying to get it all to fit together, because they all are traveling along at the same tempo. They're all in the same key, but then they also have to have very different characters.
Is this soundtrack something I'm going to instantly recognize? Is it inspired by, or does it pull from the film itself?
Oh, it pulls from the film itself. The melody is strictly Randy Newman's melody, You've Got a Friend in Me. At the same time, it's wildly different than his version of it. My apologies, Randy. You know, because the demands on it. We did a bluegrass version in one case. We did a kind of a New Orleans version. We had a lot of fun with the swing version. We did, a military band version. And each one of them has its own character, and I think stands on its own. They're fun.
Well, now you mentioned all these different versions. I mean, if we stacked them all up, I mean, you know, time-wise, how much music is there?
It's probably about 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes of different layers that we ended up using. Because one of the things we realized we were trying to do was, if we did a swing version that was very complicated, that'd be great for coming around the corner and excitement. But once we got into the actual game, maybe we needed an overlay that was going to, you know, remove two or three pieces and replace it with another piece. Because maybe once we took out all the sections we had for the jazz version, the melody was gone or something, you know, you go, oh, whoops. It's like a Dixieland thing where the guy was carrying the melody for a while and then now he's not there anymore. So we ended up, you know, replacing some of those things. And I think it could be up to 15 minutes when we were finally done.
Well, with a project like this, what would you say was the most challenging aspect?
Well, I think truly figuring out how to get the colors to be just different enough in each pass to address a character like Bo Peep, for example, who's that's a kind of a complicated character. She's kind of sassy, but she's also clearly a storybook character, you know, the mid-1800s kind of a thing, you know, a Southern belle. And you're trying to figure out how to get that voice to come through and make it different than, you know, for example, Ham, you know, where it's a country thing still, you know, little shadings of color. It took a little while to get those things right. And I think the military stuff was interesting, too. I mean, it had its own... to try to keep the feel of the song and keep the feel of the movie without keep that continuing and yet radically change the colors we were using, you know, to radically change the setting we were putting it in. I think that was probably it.
You know, it's curious to me as I hear you explain that. I mean, you're talking about the music in terms of colors and the tones from a composition standpoint. I mean, how do you look at the music in the sense? To you, is it kind of an additive element, or is the goal to kind of carry you through the attraction? How does that work?
Well, it's a little of both. It's definitely, you want it to be part of the excitement. And like I say, when we first played music and all there was the ride and music, it was clear it makes a huge difference in a way that you don't really know how to put your finger on. It's like going to a party and suddenly somebody turns on the CDs and starts playing it. You go, oh, now it feels like a party, you know. But so there's that element, which is a little hard to put your finger on, a little bit subliminal. But then the specific differences between the characters, that's what I'm hoping for people hear the most, is that it just makes them feel like they're in a new and different place each time they go to the sections of the ride.
You know, from a personal level, what are you most proud of with this particular project?
Most proud of, I think, successfully getting the different characters embodied in the different sections. Actually, the little green men, the spacemen, I showed that to Randy, and he said, yeah, that's exactly what I would think Martian would, you know, do with my song. That's good, you know. So that was important to me. I enjoyed hearing that he liked it.
So, Bruno, the day that this attraction opens, what are you most looking forward to?
Being first in line. No, I really, I'd like to watch people enjoying it and see how, I mean, I doubt people are going to go, ooh, there's the music, but I know it'll have an impact and it'll be fun to watch.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Thank you very much. Enjoy your life.
will never be mundania when you play Midway Mania.
From adventures in the world of toys, we move to the Disneyland Park, where Indiana Jones is taking guests on a thrilling series of exploits in the all-new Indiana Jones Summer of Hidden Mysteries. Guests are becoming archaeologists and unscrambling clues found on a collectible map, all while learning what life is like for one of the greatest adventure heroes of all time. Disneyland Resort Senior Show Director Glenn Kelman tells us more about the adventures awaiting Disneyland guests this summer. Today, we're kind of focused on a new show.
Well, it's more than a show. It's actually a whole overlay to Adventureland, where Indiana Jones, his adventures have kind of exploded all over Adventureland at Disneyland.
As a park guest, what can I expect to see?
Well, the first thing you can expect to see when you come into Adventureland is a giant rolling rock, like from the Raiders of the Lost Ark movie, that you can pose in front of, because that's the place where you get to start your own Indiana Jones adventure. And at that location, you can pick up a map. And that map is going to send you all over Adventureland, because Indy's left clues on the buildings. He's left clues on the Jungle Cruise. And there's even a whole new way to experience the queue to our great Indiana Jones attraction, which takes you to the Temple of the Forbidden Eye.
Well, now, we'll speak about the new, but going back to a classic attraction like the Indiana Jones one, what can I expect in the queue line there?
Well, there are things that have been hidden in that queue line since the very opening of the attraction. But now, we're going to teach you how to find it. So, for example, in Indiana Jones's office, you're going to find that there is a crate that has always been labeled to Club Obi-Wan. You're also going to find out that there are actual props that have been taken from some of the movies that you'll recognize that are hidden on that attraction queue.
Let's speak a little bit about the new. Apparently, there's kind of a new live-action event as well.
Well, yes. Indiana Jones appears throughout the land. As a matter of fact, during the days, you might see him on a rooftop or on a balcony or on a bridge fighting off an evil bad guy. And, of course, they're fighting over a map to the Temple of the Forbidden Eye. But also, at the Oasis, there is a whole new show called The Mystery of the Stone Tiger. And this is where the kids can get involved as they become archaeologists, start solving clues, and uncover a secret that not only reveals a treasure, but reveals Indiana Jones himself. And of course, whenever Indiana Jones is present, there's also somebody who wants what he has. So there's a great fight sequence that also happens there. And the kids help save the day.
Glenn, as the person who gets to work on this, I mean, you know, from a personal level, what's the part that gets you most excited?
I think what always gets me the most excited is working with great artists. You know, everything from starting to talk to the people at Lucasfilms to come up with an idea to my writer, Jason Milligan, and our art director and our art guys who are incredible Indiana Jones fans. We all get together and the energy in the room of creating something that feels like it's one of the Indiana Jones franchise films and make it live action. To get all those artists together is just an incredible experience.
Am I to expect that this is kind of an add-on to the film or kind of representative of the film? How should I interpret this event?
This is something that should make you think of all the films that you've seen. When we created our shows, we went back and we were inspired by different scenes from Raiders of the Lost Ark, from the Temple of Doom, from all the different adventures that Indy's been on. And so as you watch the shows, you'll recognize certain scenes, and certainly the music that they're fighting to is all taken from the soundtracks of the movies.
For a moment, let's pretend I'm 6 years old and I walk out of this. What do I remember?
You remember that you got to help Indy out of a really bad situation. You may also remember just seeing him fight in a bridge above your head. You might even remember the fact that when you were on the Jungle Cruise, you actually found an item that is secretly recreated from one of the films that's hidden in the Jungle Cruise, and you might have been the only one to see it.
Well, now, Glenn, when can I expect to see this attraction?
Well, this is a summer event. As a matter of fact, it's called Indiana Jones Summer of Hidden Mysteries. And so get here this summer because it's going to go away.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
The new Indiana Jones Summer of Hidden Mysteries experience happens in Adventureland daily through Labor Day weekend. If you'd like to learn more, be sure to visit the Summer of Hidden Mystery website at disneyland.com/indie. Now, the Indiana Jones Summer of Hidden Mysteries and Toy Story Mania aren't the only new attractions you'll experience this summer. Did you know that the brand new Innoventions Dream Home in Tomorrowland opens this June? It's an amazing display of integrated technology, brought to you by the creative talents of Microsoft, HP, Lifeware, Taylor Morrison, and Disneyland Entertainment. Guests will experience how home living can be made easier with today's most cutting-edge technology, and a bit of technology that's not even on the market yet. We'll have more on the Innoventions Dream Home next month. Well, that'll just about do it for this edition. If you enjoyed the show, please feel free to share it with a friend. And remember, we have both audio and video podcasts available at disneyland.com/podcast or in the iTunes podcast directory, where we also always appreciate feedback. While you're there, be sure to check out the newest video podcast. Until next time, I'm your host, Michael Gohagan. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the Disneyland Resort Podcast. And don't forget to join us next month as we continue to celebrate the power of dreams during Disney's Year of a Million Dreams.